Well, we're here at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts at Lincoln Center, and we're going to be talking about Noel Coward with Lynn Redgrave. Thank you for coming.
Delighted to have a chance to talk about him. Thanks.
Well, can you tell us, how did you meet him?
Well, I know I first met him as a child. I can't tell you exactly when, but my parents used to have boat race parties, the Oxford and Cambridge boat race, and we lived on the River Thames. And in London, and in England, indeed, that's a big boat race. And it was before the days that certainly we had television, so you just waited for that pale blue or dark blue
dark
to come
blue,
into...
Dark blue, dark blue.
Well, pale blue for me, because my dad was a Cambridge man, so was my brother. But the place, the garden, the balconies, the house were filled with show folk. And... you know, I was very, very shy, but I think he was the one who made me feel less shy, because he was just really sweet to me. I'd be terrified of everybody else, including Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh and Yehudi Menuhin and whoever else came through. But he was always just, would say something funny. And so by the time that I got to work with him, I'd met him already as a child.
Now, you were very young when you worked with him.
I was young. I was 21, and I was at the National Theatre, and it was the second season of the newly formed National Theatre at the Old Vic with Laurence Olivier as the artistic director. And the first thing I knew was that I'd been cast as Jackie, and this was some months before we were going to start in the fall, and that we had this edict from Switzerland that we must all be word perfect. We would arrive, we'd have a reading, we'd block, holding the script, and then we had to put our books down. Now, given that I was a sort of young, you know, royal courtish, sort of slightly arrogant young new Turk actor, me and others of my contemporaries thought, oh, it's going to be so old-fashioned. You know, he's just going to tell us exactly how he wants everything said. But, you know, my goodness, it's Noel Coward. We must do as we're ordered. So on a beach in Mallorca, sitting on a promontory, I learned the lines of Jackie. And I decided on that beach that Jackie Coryton should have a lisp, because she says Mrs. Bliss a lot of times, and then she has a quite amusing part in the party scene where they're playing a game where she says appendicitis. I just thought, Mrs. Bliss, appendicitis. She talks about bulls and Spain. It would be funny to have a lisp. So I turn up at the first reading and do that. And so at the first reading, Derek Jacobi was playing Simon. Wonderful Louise Purnell. Actually, it was Sarah Miles, but then it was Louise Purnell as Sorrel. Maggie Smith as Myra, and Robert Stevens as Sandy, and Robert Lang as Help, what's his name, the one that Jackie has the big scene with, Barbara Hicks, oh, Tony Nichols, I mean, great cast, and designed by Motley, and Edith Evans as Mrs. Bliss. So in comes Noel, and we sit down and we start to read, and we read through, and Laurence Olivier came up to me afterwards and said that Noel had said, the little Redgrave girl is very, very clever, but does she have a speech impediment? And Laurence Olivier assured him that I didn't have a speech impediment. And so he decided that it was very funny, and he let me keep the lisp. He liked that a lot. And sure enough, you know, we read the play, we blocked the whole show, and then it was put the books down time. But it was all... we were in for a lot of surprises, us arrogant young people who thought we knew best. He was so amazing as a director. He was the man who, or the director, who set me free. I always had, up to that point, quite a difficult time rehearsing, because the proximity of everybody in a brightly lit room made me sort of feel they were watching and judging me, and I loved it when I got on the stage and the lights went down and, there I was. But he just made me feel clever. he made me feel confident. And within, once we had our books down, which we, as I say, we did almost right away, then that was to give us freedom, to give us freedom to try anything. And he'd laugh and he'd say, oh, terribly funny scene. Oh, oh, wonderful. And I kept trying new bits of business. I felt emboldened by him. I never, you know, I thought he'd be just telling me what to do. Apart from the initial moves, great, no problem. Because he knew how to stage his own stuff and where to be standing to get the laugh and all of that. It was incredible. And when, I think it was about halfway through rehearsal that we'd been doing the third act, which I'm sure you recall actually on paper runs 15 minutes if you just read it. But each of the poor guests who've had this terrifying time come down to breakfast one at a time and have their moment with the breakfast, whatever that may be. And he came to me on a Friday and said, you're very, very clever, which was like, oh, thank you. He said, go away for the weekend and I'll give you 2 minutes from the moment you appear at the top of the stairs till you get to your breakfast. And you, if you make me laugh, you keep it in. I mean, nobody had said that to me ever before. And Noel Coward, who I now was in adoration of, as you can imagine, called me clever more than once. That was fabulous. I went away. I worked. And it's all without words. So I had to come up with business or whatever. And this gradual breakdown to complete mess that she had to be in by the time she got to the bottom. And he laughed a lot. He gave me one little adjustment that, of course, was brilliant, being him. And I got to keep it in. And it was from that moment on that I could see what rehearsals could be and felt emboldened and not like, oh, I'm nervous because the room is lit and obviously people are judging me. I suppose that, you know, if you've just been judged by this genius and come up okay, why not try anything, anytime?
He's bringing it out of you rather than imposing it.
Yes, yes. And I mean, he easily could have. I'm sure anything he would have told me to do would be clever and funny. But I guess he knew and it was because he trusted me that made me feel so good, that if it was my own invention, it would be funnier than me trying to slavishly copy what he suggested. Mm. He was so generous to young people. And Dame Edith Evans was a little less than generous to young women. She felt very insecure. I was the youngest of the young women. But Maggie Smith, who already was a big West End star with Mary Mary, and she'd been in those amazing reviews, Share My Lettuce and all those things. I think Dame Edith felt threatened by Maggie's talent, really. And she would refer to her as the little Smith girl, which didn't go down very well with Maggie. And Dame Edith was very upset too, and something I now so sympathize with, I was perhaps less than sympathetic back then, was having line learning trouble. And so right early on, Noel had decided that, God forbid Edith would be off, but supposing she was, you can't just put on anybody. They've come to see Edith. And so he asked Maggie, only 30 years old, would she cover the part? And Maggie graciously said she would, and that was sort of kept rather quiet from Dame Edith, but mm-hmm. just so that a star would go on if Edith, God forbid, would be off. And of course Edith found out. And one day she said to Maggie, I understand that you are covering the role of Judith Bliss. I'd like to tell you here and now, I shall not be off. And Maggie said, oh, I sincerely hope not, because the cosies won't fit. Dame Edith was incensed by that. She loved all the young men. She loved Derek Jacobi. She particularly loved Robert Stevens. You know, just loved all the attention from them. But I just think she was threatened. I don't know whether there was anything personal against me because She'd had a brief affair with my father. She'd been desperately in love with him. Maybe I don't know. That might have raised some sort of thing. But she was always kind of telling Noel how we were all putting her off. You know, well, Noel, you know, I can't do this because the little Redgrave girl or the little Smith girl or the little Hicks girl, who was Barbara Hicks, was playing Clara. And this got particularly dangerous when it came to, it was still back in the old days of costume parades, they used to call them. So, you know, you'd come to the theater and you'd get into your costume for the first time at the beginning of the onstage time. And you'd literally come out on stage and everybody would have a look, the director, the designer, have a look at your costume and approve it. Nobody does that anymore. I guess they've cut down the hours or something. And I was coming out of my dressing room. I had a wonderful costume for Act Two for the game scene. And it was all handkerchief points and yellow and divine. And Sophie Harris had given me a big white feather. It was about this tall, great big thing that I was to hold as a prop. And Jackie, the character, is very awkward. But I also, even in those days, but as I am today, I mean, I was raised by a bunch of professionals, so the last thing I would ever do is move a big white something during somebody's line or spoil their laugh or anything. I mean, I absolutely knew that from all my training, from my background, from everything. But I come out of my room, and there's Dame Edith, and she says, "What's that?" I said, "It's a feather, Dame Edith. Isn't it lovely?" I'm, like, quaking. And she's, "Well, what are you going to do with it?" I'm like, "Oh, she's going to get it cut. She's going to run down, and she'll tell Noel that it'll put her off or something." So I ran down on the stage, and I said, "Look, what do you think?" He said, "Absolutely brilliant." And panting behind me comes to me, "That's the little red great girl's feather." "Brilliant, Edith. It's absolutely brilliant. Now, your dress." Now, so moving on. But he was sort of naughty but brilliant with her. It was a bit naughty, you know, but he's Noel Coward.
But as a director, how different was he from other directors you worked with on Coward or anything?
Well, I've never worked with anybody quite like him, and I've worked with some wonderful, wonderful directors. But he made us feel free while absolutely having a structure to rehearsals and to how they were conducted and to what the finished product would be. I mean, it was from him that I learned, really, about comedy. I mean, I had a natural funny bone, I suppose. But he would always say to us, in the first act, if you can kill the laugh, kill it. Like, nobody ever says that, they say. You know, "Oh, you've got a laugh almost there, come on." And he said, if you can stop it, then it's not big enough. Stop it or they'll be exhausted by the third act. And he was so right. Nobody ever tells you that anymore. The slightest titter and they want you to build it up and build it up. And he understood comedy, I think, certainly more than any director I've worked for.
Because he played it himself.
He played
so
it
well.
Himself, he wrote it himself, he completely understood it, yeah. Absolutely.
And that was the cast that could play the Albanian telephone director?
Well,
he said, didn't he?
He really did say that, which was kind of nice to think we could play the Albanian telephone director. Yeah, it was really wonderful.
When did you call him Dad?
I called him Dad because, obviously, I got very, very fond of him, and he was really fond of me. But there was an article in one of the Sunday newspaper magazines. I can't remember now if it was the Observer or the Sunday Times. And because he had been kind of, as you know, on the outs with, you know, how could he go to Switzerland and, you know, how everybody liked to be mean about people who left the country. Mm. Because the taxes, of course, were horrendous back then, weren't they, for above a certain level.
Yeah, they were.
Just ridiculous. So he was, the fact that he'd been asked to direct one of his plays at the National Theatre was huge because he'd been kind of, "Oh, Noel Coward, very funny back then." So there was an article which quoted him, and its title was "It's Dad's Renaissance," and he'd referred to himself. So we all read it, and I came in at the next rehearsal. It may have even come out on the Tech Weekend, so we were there on a Sunday. And I made up a little, I can't remember all the words, but sort of like a music hall song. I came on sort of going, it's Dad's Renaissance, it's Dad's Renaissance. And he laughed like a drain. And then I just started calling him Dad, and he called himself Dad to me. And what was remarkable was he was so, he so loved young performers. And he came from then on to every opening night I had after I'd left the National. My first sort of big West End opening night was in Michael Frayn's first plays, The Two of Us, with Richard Briers. And this huge bouquet arrived on the opening night. I went, oh, I opened it up, and there was a note. And it said, please speak clearly and with great beauty, love, Dad. And he was out there. And he was out there for David Hare's play Slag, which was not his cup of tea, but he was there. Just one, and he sent me a telegram when I had my children, called himself Dad again.
And he'd come round after the show, wouldn't he?
Yes, absolutely come round after the show. And in the case I remember with the David Hare play at the Royal Court, I think he was already in poor health from whatever that horrible bug he had.
Yeah.
So we were told he wanted to see us, me, Anna Massey, and Barbara Ferris, and very sorry he couldn't come, but he's in the lobby where we come out, in the foyer. Of course, we rushed out, couldn't wait to see him.
There's a lovely picture of the two of you. I think it's outside the Dorchester.
Yes.
He's in an oriental chair.
He's in a big chair. That was because one of his short stories, Pretty Polly, was made into a television play, we used to call them then. And this was after I'd left the National. And a wonderful story of a very plain Jane girl with a hideous aunt who, the aunt dies and then she sort of finds love and blossoms forth and all of that. And so I remember that wonderful day when they did this big sort of rather hokey shot outside the Dorchester, which was where he was staying. And in that big, big fan-like chair. And he was lovely about that play too. I mean, just lovely.
Well, you played in everybody. You played Shaw, you played Morn.
Mm, mm.
How would you put him into that sort of gallery of playwrights?
Well, I think he's a real genius because clearly his comedy is extraordinary, but, you know, there was so much to him. There was so much underneath the plays. And the fact that you laugh a lot doesn't conceal from me that there's some really sort of dangerous life going on, you know. When you think of the setup of Design for Living, I mean, wait a minute, what a story is that? What a story is that between those three? I think it's fascinating.
But then young directors are inclined to come to it and say, oh, well, why don't we make it more overt? And yet Noel himself always felt that it should be by implication rather than by being explicit.
Right, I think so. I mean, you know, and they're his plays, but I would totally agree with that because there is a style to the way people talked in his plays, there's no question, and maybe people talked back then, as they say. And if you try to make it too written today, you're just going to really miss so much of it. And I don't know, I think they're brilliant, and of course they have to be wonderfully cast. I mean, I do think that Maggie Smith, when she was in Private Lives, I thought, it was an incredible performance. Absolutely amazing, amazing. And then again, I also, on the darker side, I did love the one with Alan Rickman. That was a lot darker as a production. But boy, was it interesting. And they were funny too, him and
Lindsay. Well, one could argue Private Lives is really about the impossibility of love, isn't it?
It absolutely is, yeah.
These two people are killing each other and
yes.
Anybody who comes into contact with them.
Yeah, 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 absolutely.
And that is being played more by younger directors than it has in the past. It was all done for the laughs. But remember the line that Coward talks about, puts into one of the plays, small talk, lots of small talk, with other thoughts going on behind.
Yeah.
That's true of much of his work, isn't it?
So true, absolutely. Wonderful. I don't know, I mean, he's... I do count it as one of the... Well, perhaps the most amazing thing that happened to me as a theatre actor was getting to work with him. I sometimes think, well, where would I be if I hadn't worked with him? What wouldn't I know? What would I be milking those first act laughs? What would I be doing? What? I don't know. I felt changed by him forever, and only for the best.
Is there a Coward part you'd still like to play, or to play again?
Well, I wish I'd played Amanda in Private Lives. I took part in a few readings and things where one did selected scenes, and that certainly whetted my appetite for it. I would love to play Madame Arcati, actually. That would be really fun. And Amanda in Private Lives, I guess that's what I. But I mean, I'm past the sell-by date for Amanda, that's for sure. But maybe Madame Arcati.
Judith.
I would love to play Judith Bliss. Yes, actually, I would. I would love that. That would be. It would be really fun too to have played Jackie and then to.
Play that.
That would be wonderful.
And what would you do with that, different from, say, Edith Evans or Judy Dench?
Well, I didn't see Judy Dench, so I heard she was marvellous. I mean, Edith was often absolutely marvellous, but she was going through not perhaps the very best primer for her. You know, it was a difficult time for her. So it was a little uneven, but she could do things with such style. One night she had this long row of pearls, and I know a bunch of us were going to be coming through the French windows any minute. Can't remember which act, probably the second act or something, I don't know. And she's holding them out, and suddenly one of the strings breaks, and there were pearls cascading all over the floor. I mean, so much so that as we came through the French windows, Maggie Smith said, "No, it's like Aladdin's cave." And it was. But Edith absolutely stayed in character. She had this sort of filthy piece of string that she just kept, you know, in absolute style. And I was there. I was actually present for the famous Marlowe story.
Tell it.
I actually was. Well, there's a line that Mrs. Bliss has in... where she has to say, she's looking out the window, and Dame Edith would say, "On a very clear day, you can see Marlowe." Marlowe is a town in this area. And Edith, Noel said, "Edith, darling, it's not on a very clear day, it's on a clear day you can see Marlowe." And she said, "Oh, of course. On a very clear day," and off it would go again. And finally he stopped her and he said, "Edith, darling, on a clear day, you can see Marlowe. On a very clear day, you can see Marlowe, Beaumont and Fletcher."
One of the best stories.
It's a great story, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
And what did she say to that?
She was like, "Oh, yeah." You go crazy.
Now, were you in the production still when Celia Johnson took
I over? Was, and Celia was wonderful, I must say. Very, very different, of course. I mean, but Mrs. Bliss can be played by so many people. But, and I'd made my West End debut with Celia Johnson as her daughter in an N.C. Hunter play called Tulip Tree. So it was heaven for me to be with her again. Again, one of the kindest, funniest, sweetest people that you could work with. Just heavenly.
She played Coward well, didn't she? And a lot.
Really well, and a lot, absolutely, yes. Brief encounter,
I love the story of how she could get emotional and then stop. And she said, "Well, of course, I'm as blind as a bat, so I can't see anything, so there's no distraction." You know that?
That's a good point. I didn't know that one. That's funny.
Nothing to take the focus off because I can't see.
I can't really see. That's lovely. That's so lovely.
Now, why do you think it is that younger people who are finding Coward, and fortunately for us, there are more and more of them here and in the UK.
Yes.
What do you think it is about him that they're seeing now that a previous generation ignored? I mean, as you rightly say, he was famous and then he was yesterday's man.
Yes.
And then there was the Renaissance. I think we're beyond the Renaissance now. I think we're in a coward restoration.
I think absolutely, yes. It's way beyond a Renaissance. And maybe it's just that time has to pass. You know how when certain plays that have been successful in a certain era are revived too soon, everybody goes, oh, I need to have waited a bit longer. But he was, of course, so prolific with his work, his musicals, the plays, the reviews, the everything. I don't know, I just hold a sort of personal theory that a lot of the, oh, he's past it thing was sheer British, you know, bloody-mindedness. He left the country, we don't like him. Mm-hmm. I mean, the British can be just lethal that way when they decide that somebody betrayed them in some way. He didn't betray them. He rightly wanted to earn his money, you know, and not have, what was it, 95% or something with the super tax back then?
19 and 11 then. In the pound
or something. Yeah. But, you know, I know for myself that when I first left Britain to live in America and had maybe been here 10 years, and I've now actually been here more than half my life, I would get very short shrift back in England. Do you like living in America? What's it like having children of American accents? And you just want to say, oh, grow up. You all wish you were here. Stop it.
Mm. I've had the same kind of...
I'm sure you've had the same
I've been here 30 years and people say, yes. What do you want to live there for?
Yeah, these are usually people who haven't been here and wish they had.
Yeah, and couldn't get
and
there.
And they're not going to. So I think it was an absolute British thing. I really do.
And it hurt him more than he was prepared to give credit for.
I think so. I think absolutely. And that's why his invitation to be at the National, I think, really, genuinely meant so much to him.
Yeah, no question.
Really did.
Well, I mean, he made most of the later part of his career here. I mean, he wrote his shows for Broadway, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the Americans never gave up on him.
No.
As the Brits did.
You know, that tends to be. I mean, I don't think generally in the American spirit there's that that sort of, I don't know what to call it. It's not pessimism, it's... What would you call it? You know, that thing of, oh, let's put something down rather than applaud it, you know.
It's kind of a fear, I think.
Yeah,
they
I think it is.
They don't understand it.
Right.
And they also don't want you to have it if they haven't got it.
That's right.
Whereas the Americans say, this is getting into commercial for America.
Yes.
The Americans say, if you can make it, good for you.
Yeah.
I want to make it too,
and you're a sign that people can make it.
Yeah.
But it's very... It can be very different.
And when he went to Las Vegas, that was a revelation for him, wasn't it?
Fantastic, that, yes. Oh.
You ever see him in a cabaret?
Never. I wish I had. I heard that. It was an album then, you know, the Las Vegas, Live from Las Vegas thing. That was incredible. I wish I'd been there. That would have been great.
And somebody once said to him, is there anything you can't do? And he said, well, I'm not doing too well with sawing ladies in half. And I don't think I could dance in my own ballet.
Oh, that's really good.
But other than that, he did most things, didn't he?
He did.
Have you any other little thoughts on Noel?
We've covered it mostly, I think.
What was the last time you saw him?
I think the last time I saw him, he was really unwell, and it was at a reception at the Savoy. What I'm trying to remember is, was it a party for him? He was in a wheelchair. What I think is possible is that it wasn't a party for him, but that it was a party for Joan Sutherland. I've just got this image that I know she was there, I know he wasn't well, and I think it was probably about maybe a year or so before he passed away. And he always was so loving to me, so, so sweet. So kind, always said something funny and adorable. I guess I got the absolute best of him, you know, and I'm so grateful for that.
Well, in a very late interview, he was asked if he could sum up his career and his life in one word, and he said, he thought a bit, he said, now comes the big decision whether to be corny or not, but there is one word, and that word is love. He said, to know that you are with people who love you, who you love, has made all the success that much more wonderful than it would have been anyway. And then he paused and he said, and that's it, really. I think that's it, really. Well, as one displaced Brit to another, thank you, Lynn.
Thank you, Barry, very much.